This week's episode of So Wrong It's Right was brought to you by Foxy Bingo. Put some Fox in your day with new, quick and interactive bingo experiences all at the tip of your finger. They have a huge range of free, classic and exclusive games you can play with your mates to keep the party going. Want to connect with other players? Foxy Bingo has a community chat so you can always feel part of the Foxy pack. So get your Fox on by heading to Foxy Bingo today. 18 plus, begambleaware.org, T's and C's apply.
I do find it weird that some of these people that you dated like exist in our family memories because you took them places. And I'm like, oh, who was that? You actually don't want to be the smartest or the most accomplished person in the room. If I'm in that room, I need to move up to the next room.
I can imagine I could be like dying and she'd be like, come in and be like, you're dying, bitch.
You'd be like, open the coffin and take it off her.
I would.
Georgia Atwood-Lawry, welcome to So Wrong, It's Right.
I can't.
So what was that? She was an audible, I can't. Are you regretting this?
Not yet.
So let's take it back to when we were kids. I don't even know where to start with this. When we were little, Georgia and I, well, I'm very surprised that we've both made it to adult life because we definitely, I used to dream about killing you. Like, let's just start there. Like, I actually used to dream about just ending you. And I think you felt the same way.
I know.
We fought, like, it was insane how much you fought, wasn't it?
It was wild.
In between, there were moments, obviously, like all little sisters, where we played together and stuff, but it would always end in tears.
Yours. Your tears.
Yours. Tell everyone what I was like as a child from your viewpoint, because I think it will surprise them a lot.
I think it would surprise people. You were definitely quite quiet. I feel like you were actually borderlining on being like quite vanilla and meek. Like you were quite cute. And like a little bit scatty, but in like a very unoffensive way, I would say. And I feel, I don't know when like the loudness and like the gobshite part of you came in, but it definitely wasn't from a child.
No, I was like painfully shy, I would say, when I was young, around people I didn't know. Like if Georgia and I we used to go to like summer camps or we started a new school, my sister would be the one like to go ahead first and like, I would hold her hand and she would kind of lead the way, or you'd make friends and then I'd have to be like, can I hang
out? I was always making friends. I feel like, not saying you were like a loser and didn't have any friends, but you did.
I'm regretting you found it
harder than me, for sure. And I would like make friends and be like, these are our friends.
Yeah.
You can hang with us for now.
My sister, you were confident. You were like headstrong. You weren't scared of people. Like we have this home video that sounds so... Well, we actually spent part of our childhood in Canada, so it was a home
video. This was the 90s, so our mum and dad had like a full-size camcorder strapped to their hands for our entire childhood. So most things are recorded.
Most things are recorded. They are quite iconic. And there's a video where we come back from like play school and a boy had like picked on me. And we're how old? What, four, five?
I was really young. I'd say I was... Yeah. Four.
And then...
No, younger, maybe three even, and you were four.
So he was picking on me, he was like, kept taking my hat off my head, and my sister came out of nowhere and just smacked him.
Yeah.
And she was documenting it on the video. She's like, I mack him, that's just saying.
Yeah, I was like, I pulled his hair and I smacked him.
I think that we found it harder to get along the older we got, right?
Yeah, I would say so.
And I think our different personalities, it became more, we were so different and it kind of, I think when you're younger, you're kind of forced to be together. And then we went to boarding school and we were the first sisters in the history of the school to go into separate boarding houses by choice.
That was your request, surprisingly.
Yeah, I know, because I was terrified of you.
That's not why.
I wanted to keep...
That's not why, it's because you wanted to establish yourself as the cool one. You knew if I came into your house, that would never happen. So she literally started a petition to have me put in a separate boarding house.
What do you mean I knew it would never happen?
You just knew it wouldn't happen if I was too close to you, so you, like, exiled me to the other boarding house.
And then you had your reign of terror over there.
Exactly.
And I was free from it. And everything we did as kids, we had to do. So, like, if one started a hobby, the next week I'd be like, I want to do that hobby. Like, I want to do piano. And I was such... you really built me out to be such a loser when I was little. Maybe I was a bit of a loser. Said, like, someone that feels sorry for a loser.
Yeah, I said... Yeah.
But I was really into cross-country running.
Wait, and I had... Wait, you were in cross-country running. I had chess.
Oh, my fencing. God.
Sorry, what? I went to full-on chess tournaments, like, of a whole Saturday. So you're trying to act like running makes you uncool. Like, I was a chess champion.
Yeah, that's
Just let that sit for a moment.
That's fair.
And then I took up fencing to, like, fight with swords. Like, what? Sorry, that's so rude to all the fencers. Really skilled sport. It's kind of weird.
It's still
a weird combo, chess fencing situation.
Yeah. How did you become popular? You weren't popular at school then. You dropped them when you went to secondary school era.
I dropped that like a hot brick. They were out.
But when I did the running, then she said, I want to do running. And even though you weren't naturally a runner, and we did around the track. And when we went down a second time, she had gone into the toilet and locked herself in there. Oh, that's funny. And then as we've got older, I would say, like, over the last 10 years, we've become closer. I think not living together has helped.
I think that's definitely helped.
Yeah, because we were so different in the house, and my sister, her room was like this lair where you just couldn't even basically see the floor. And
it's still the same. How scary is that?
Terrifying.
Like, I really actually think I have my shit together in life. And then I look at my bedroom and I'm like, what is wrong with you?
You ever seen that film, A New York Minute, Mary Kate and Ashley? And like in the morning, it's like they go to the two rooms and it's like the contrast. We could not be more contrast in that sense. Like, I put everything in cubes, everything's color coded, everything has like a tab on it. It's almost like psychopathic. And then your stuff. We went to Hamburg recently to visit our nan, and my sister just like gets her makeup bag on the side of the sink and just like tips it upside down. And I was like, oh my God, if I'm going to have a seizure. I was like, I can't, we were sharing.
That's like my freedom though. Cause if you've got it together all the time, like, there's nothing better than just getting home and being a complete slob. Like, just throw your shit everywhere.
Let it go.
Focus on the important things.
And I had all my stuff so meticulous in my room. Like, I literally had my shit color coordinated. It was weird. And then she kept stealing my stuff. And it was driving me, like, my reaction to it, I have to admit, wasn't proportionate.
Unhinged.
Yeah, like, it was bad. So my mum and dad agreed to let me have a lock on my door. It was like a big moment.
They had the locksmiths in and had an actual lock and, like, a key card for her bedroom.
So...
Because she didn't want to share.
Do you know what this fucking bitch did? She went into my dad's office, mm-hmm. She stole the key and she had one cut. She had a key cut. So then she was letting herself into my bedroom.
Taking things.
Or like she'd wear it and then put it back. And then I would go in and be like, something's moved. Like, and I'd be going to my mum, I'm like, someone's in my room. She's like, Olivia, you've lost it. Like, the room is locked. So I'm like, someone's.
Because I put the original key back where it was hidden, so you would know.
No one knew.
And sometimes I'd move things just to fuck with you. Like, just really subtly. Like, I wouldn't even take anything, but like the colours would be mixed up and I'd just take one top out and just put it somewhere weird. Just cause.
I see a child therapist over this. I used to literally sleep with one eye open. It was nuts. But anyway, we move out. I get over the trauma of...
Yeah, the trauma of your sister going into your walk-in wardrobe in your giant bedroom and, like, stealing your designer clothes. It's tragic.
Quite a big period in my life, which I probably was unaware of how big a period it was in your life without your choice, was when I was in Love Island. Mm. Can only apologise again for... I think for people... Well, I obviously was ignorant to it. We didn't know Love Island Series 3 was going to go as big as it did. And I think when you're in a show like that and you're cut off from reality, it's the hardest it is on the people, your family, because you're basically the... Everyone's coming to you.
Yeah.
And it was tough, from what I've heard.
It was really tough. It feels like so long ago now, but there was just... lots of layers of like why it was difficult. I think it was, it blew up that series, didn't it? Like, mm-hmm. I think it was maybe one of the most watched ones or whatever. But everybody was watching. It felt like the whole world was watching, you know, like everyone I worked with, everyone like I would meet, like it was just hysteria. And I feel like like Instagram and stuff was all really kind of coming into its own then and taking off. And I think I was managing your social media at the time. And I think there was, like, as always with these things, there was love for you, but your eyes are drawn to the negative comments.
Yeah.
And because I was trying to manage it and I would see and read these things, like, I found it so traumatizing. Like, I was like, she's gonna see the stuff when she comes out and she's gonna be devastated and it's all gonna be over for her. Like, obviously I was completely wrong, but in the moment, like, that's where your head's going, and so you're like frantically trying to control these things that you can't control, and then sort of absorb these negative comments, these weird messages, and it was just crazy. And then another layer on top, like trying to deal with our family through that was just beyond. In fact, they were probably the worst, I would say. Yeah.
It was like that, you know, from what I've heard of being in there, it's like too many cooks in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Like you say, it was uncharted territory. No one expected the show to go so big. So everyone's family experienced something similar. But it's like, you know, you say, I just literally left. And I was like to my sister, who doesn't even care about social media, like barely, you know, she doesn't even post on her own. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, oh, can you just post a photo once a week? For, like, you know, it was not like a thing. It didn't even
I was
think.
Quite on it though. Like, I took the job really seriously because I really wanted you to be successful. So I was really taking it seriously. But then all my family would weigh in with like their opinions. And obviously every single one of them just wanted the best for you as well.
Yeah.
But in terms of respect, not good what they were wanting to post. So that was really stressful managing that. We would have like full on internal debates in the family over like which picture to post or like what caption to put. And I was like, is this actually my life? Because I have a full-time job.
At current position, you are MD of business development. That's in your right. corporate company.
Yeah.
How did you get to your role? Because you didn't go for the classic route. Wasn't uni, wasn't... You were good at school, you're better than me, that doesn't fucking take much. But you have kind of like hustled your way to this incredible position.
So it's definitely been a journey, and I think with each move I've made, I've taken a step up and into different industries and certainly like different levels of responsibility. But I will say that for me, from the beginning, I always wanted to be in sales and business development. I don't know why I knew that, but I did. And I think maybe it's because the nature of a lot of sales roles is that you get compensated typically based on what you bring to the table. So you have that opportunity to progress really quickly if you're really good. Whereas I feel like, you know, other career paths can be a bit more structured, where it's like, well, when you've done 5 years, you can finally do this. And when you've done 6 years, you can do that. And oh, you can't have this pay rise because we benchmark against another person. Like, I knew that was never going to work for me because I put in a lot to my work and I love what I do. So I feel that I've been able to bring something really different to the table. I can sit around a room with really amazing, really educated people who excel in their individual fields. But I've been able to bring, you know, those sales skills and that commercial acumen that helps a business grow and acquire clients. And so, you know, that really all started with getting a foothold in a very entrepreneurial company who were willing to take on people who hadn't been to university and train them. Like, you know this in your line of work, like the relationships that you build are so important. So I would always encourage people to really get out of their seats if they can in their job and meet as many people as possible. You know, every opportunity you get to meet new clients, you know, new prospective contacts, there can't be enough people that you know. And when you find people that you think you've built relationships where they're going to be useful to you, you put the work in and really foster those relationships, because those potentially will be the people that support you and kind of get you that role and that next step.
How do you nurture those relationships that you make? How do you kind of keep them alive?
I think it's being useful to those people, right? Like, I think obviously you'll meet people who are super nice and they'll just want to help, but that's not the majority of people. And I think in every time you're trying to reach out to somebody new, you kind of want to think, well, what's in it for them? And so I think about that a lot when I'm meeting new people or when I'm prospecting a new client, I reach out. I'm like, what's in it for them? We know what's in it for me. I want to meet with them. They'll be a good contact for me, potentially want to sell them something. But what do they get out of this meeting? And so whatever industry you're in, perhaps it's that you can help them with some market intelligence, or you know something that's useful to them, or maybe you've got a contact you can introduce them to. But I kind of keep that in my head, even when I'm reaching out and I'm meeting these people. It's like, what can I do for them that makes me a value add in their network? Yeah. And I think if you can unlock that, you're going to get a lot more meetings. You're going to be able to continue these relationships and be respected as a peer.
That's a really good one. I feel like a lot of people are so focused on what they need and want from people that actually, like you say, in any workplace, even in my workplace, it's like if you think what, like you say, if you make yourself a valuable asset, then you kind of put yourself in a stronger position. Having like got yourself to a managing director position, do you ever feel imposter syndrome?
Yeah, 100%. I talk about this with some of my colleagues sometimes, particularly other younger female colleagues. I think I do, for sure. And especially because, you know, sometimes I'll walk into a room and there'll be people with, you know, 20, 30 plus years experience, PhDs, MDs, you know, all these kind of things. So yeah, I definitely feel that. I try and overcome that by remembering what I bring to the table, and it's not the same as them. Like, it's not, you can't compare apples to apples. Like, we're not bringing the same skill set to the table.
No.
I'm bringing something different that more often than not is not an area that they add value in, but something where I can add value in. So I would, you know, if people are experiencing that, they've accelerated in their careers and they find themselves in rooms where they feel out of their depth, you've got to remind yourself why you got there and what it is that got you there, because there's a reason you're in the room, and it will be because somebody around you maybe doesn't have that particular skill set.
I think a lot of people suffer with imposter syndrome. I think it's something that is really relatable, and you can feel it on different scales. And I've definitely had moments over the last like 5 years of huge imposter syndrome where I'm in situations where I'm like, should I be here? Or even I get things like, you know, I'm putting out a show and then people are watching it and I'm like, why are they watching this? Like, why would anyone want to watch this? But I was actually talking to my therapist about imposter syndrome, and he said that, he summed it up in a really interesting way. He said, it happens to your brain when you're doing something so seamlessly with such ease that you start to almost feel like you shouldn't be there. So when you're doing something and you're fearful of it and you're learning it and you're out of your comfort zone, you don't feel it because you're so focused on like being the thing. But then when you're doing something like navigating a boardroom or doing live telly and it's just natural, all of a sudden you think, oh my God, this is the easiest job in the world. Anyone could do this. Why am I doing it? But actually it's not the easiest job in the world. You have just, it's become easy for you.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that resonates with you?
I think it 100% resonates. And I also think, you know, you actually don't want to be the smartest or the most accomplished person in the room. Like, I don't want to be in that room. Like, I want to, if I'm in that room, I need to move up to the next room, right?
Interesting.
Because you want to be around people that bring something different or more experience, or you can learn something. If you're somebody who is ambitious and wants to grow, you will find that that's not the room you want to be in.
Yeah. One thing that we both love, cash. Yeah. How does one ask for a pay rise?
That is such a broad question. Okay, so really important. I think it's really important for women to be able to advocate for themselves in this situation. Typically, like, things are catching up, but the equal pay is still a topic of discussion in a lot of industries. And I think speaking up is part of that. And every company you are with might have different rules and structures. So this might not apply to everybody, but maybe just some small nuggets of advice. First and foremost, pick your moment, right? So whatever industry you're in, think about the environment that you're in. Are you in a good market? You're in a down market? Are things going well for your company? Is your company succeeding? Are you succeeding? Is, you know, what kind of frame of mind is the person who you're asking the pay rise for in? Mm. And these are little things, but it's like things people don't think about. Like, maybe if your boss has just been traveling for 2 months and has just got off a plane and walked into the office, maybe then's not the moment to pull them for a chat and ask for the pay rise.
Okay.
But it happens. People do this. People have done this to me. And
I'll... Fucking hell, if I would ask you for a fucking pay rise, Jesus Christ. Wouldn't ask you for coffee. I think that it's really interesting for my audience to hear a little bit about you as a person and what you do. And I just know that so many people can apply a lot of that to their own workplace, whatever their workplace is. I think that is like really valuable information. And it's nice for my audience to get to know more about you. But one thing that I think a lot of them do know, especially people that follow me on Instagram, because I've posted little nuggets about your journey of endometriosis. And oh my God, when I do, the reaction is insane. Like if I posted, I think, a story once when you were coming out of one of your last surgeries, and I'm not joking, I had easily 5,000 DMs in 24 hours of girls just and women just calling out for like, can we hear more about her story? Can like help? Like, I'm in a desperate situation. So I just really want to go into that chat for all the girls listening, because I just want to get this stat. Is it one in 10 women in the UK suffer endometriosis?
Yeah, and I think it's like 190 million women globally.
It's insane. It's
it affects more people than asthma and diabetes.
Wow.
And so you think about how many treatments there are and how, you know, good the diagnosis is for those conditions. And then with endometriosis, I think it takes between 7 and 9 years.
Tell my listeners your story of endometriosis, because my sister was ill 4 years.
I mean, it started about 10 years ago was when I got on the path to diagnosis, but I've had a journey with it. I've had, laparoscopy surgeries.
Which essentially surgeries to remove cysts.
To remove like very large cysts. They categorise grade 4 endometriosis by having these large solid cysts. So that's what I've been affected by each time. But actually the journey, the symptoms have been kind of different every time. The first time I was really quite young. I guess I would have been in my late teens. And I'd say my symptoms were more classic of the condition, which is like horrendous period pains, you know, really unwell when I was on my period, like physically sick, just agonizing pain, kind of all the issues that came with that. And I, you know, something I feel quite strongly about is at the time, you know, I really shelved that pain because for me it was period pain, and period pain is normal.
Well, as we're educated.
As we're educated.
Which is actually false information.
Completely false information. And look, mild discomfort, different story. Agonizing pain where you're lying on the bathroom floor and you can't get to work, or you have to excuse yourself from a meeting because you can't catch your breath because the pain's so bad. That's not normal. But it's so crazy to think that through your education, nobody talks to you about that. Mm-hmm. Nobody says, oh, by the way, if you're feeling that way, you might want to see a doctor. And, you know, 10 years has passed since then. I think things have improved. But even, like, I remember I had to excuse myself from a meeting I was in. And I was really young at the time. And I was in one of my first kind of corporate jobs with amazing boss anyway. And she kind of looked at me in the meeting and I was just going white, like so ill. And she sort of whispered to me, she was so lovely. She was like, do you need to go? And I was like, I'm just going to go to the toilet. So I had to walk out in the middle of a meeting, which is really embarrassing. I had to go to the toilet and the pain was so bad, I thought I was going to pass out there and then. Like I was practically coming in and out of consciousness. And then the pain kind of subsided within the hour. And so I sort of was walking out, I was in London. I was going to grab a car all the way back to Surrey. And I remember calling my GP surgery, and I think they put me through to somebody, and I was like, oh my God, I'm in so much pain and da da da. And they were like, well, periods are painful. And I was like, okay, I suppose they are. And I just took it. And then it was actually my mum, amazingly, not amazing, I'm not surprised that she's always so good with things like this, but you know, I was quite young. She was like, have you ever been to the gynecologist? I don't think you have. Like, maybe we'll take you. And luckily I had access to that. Like, that's privilege to be able to go and just book an appointment with a gynecologist and have health insurance do that. But I was like, yeah, maybe I should. And then I did, which is, I was a lot younger than I guess your kind of standard age for a smear test or a checkup or whatever. And they did the scan and yeah, it was grade 4 endometriosis. It was really severe.
What are the grades from 1 to 4? Is that, that's it? So 1 to 4, and it's basically on the amount of cysts or the size of the cysts, or?
I'd have to check on like the actual clarification of like what each stage means. Mm. But obviously grade four is the most severe. And I believe that's when the endometriosis has gotten so bad that it's forming solid cysts. So don't quote me on that.
Because at one point you had a cyst that was so large that if it had burst, you could have literally died.
Yeah.
Which is something that happens because it can cause sepsis.
Yeah, this is the crazy thing. Then, so I had that diagnosis at the time when I was 19. I had surgery and that was really effective for me. I was really well for like a good number of years. And then just before the COVID pandemic and the lockdown, I started to get really sick again, but with a whole different group of symptoms, nothing to do with period pain, nothing to do with periods, vomiting, fevers, exhaustion, like acid reflux, all this weird stuff. And I didn't put two and two together because it wasn't to do with periods. So again, like the education thing, I was like, oh no, but I've had endometriosis and that's a period issue.
Mm.
So I didn't connect the dots. And anyway, I went through a whole nother set of trying to be diagnosed. And, you know, again, like there's so much I could say on this topic, but I saw a male gastroenterologist because I'd been referred to him from my GP because of like the upper gastric symptoms.
So like gastric, then you'd like stomach doctor basically.
Yeah, yeah. So they did all the tests, like the scope, and everything was normal. There was nothing wrong. And he was like, no, everything's normal. And I was so ill. I remember saying to him, I was like, look, I've had a diagnosis of endometriosis 5 years ago and I had surgery. Do you think maybe it could be connected? And he just went, no, don't be silly. Are you under stress? Like, are you a bit stressed? And I was like, oh, maybe I am stressed. Like, but obviously I knew I wasn't. Like, that's not the cause
of this. The thing is, like you said, I remember you said this to me at the time, you would never ask a man that. That's the first thing.
Never.
Like, someone would never question, like, a man's reports of being ill.
No way.
And a stat I have here is, on average, it takes 2.5 years longer for women to get diagnosed with any condition.
That does not surprise me. Versus
men. Because I think, like you say, with the false information about periods not being taken seriously when we say we're in pain, our pain is not considered in the same way it is towards men. What would your advice be to someone listening who is struggling with excruciating period and they feel like they might have endometriosis?
I think a few things. I think it's really important that people can advocate for themselves in a healthcare setting. That's something I really learned the hard way and always let it get to a point of it being really bad before I'd kind of really stand up for myself, right? Like, I think little things, if you feel like you're being, okay, first and foremost, if you think you've got endometriosis, do go and see your GP or your first line of care doctor and say, you know, I've done my research, like I've got these symptoms, I feel like I could have endometriosis. I think you're allowed to say that. And of course, you know, you're not the medical professional. They'll give their guidance. I think things are much better now. Like awareness is much better. You might have quite a different experience than the one I had. But then, you know, if you feel like you're not being listened to, then you are within your rights to stand up for yourself. You know, when I was the second time around, when my cyst was so bad and so big, like I had to have emergency surgery the next day in the end. I was so bad, I was in A&E. And again, I got asked the question, oh, are you stressed? And, you know, the particular person I had said, oh, are you stressed? And, oh, can you go, I think you need to go home. And I said, I don't know why, it just came to me. I said, I'd like you to put that in my notes. Like, sorry, I know it makes me sound like a bit of a Karen, but like, I was just Karen over here was like, please, can you write that down? Like, I want to know that you've made a record of the fact that I'm in agony and I'm not coping and you are sending me home. And it was really funny because when I said that, they were like, oh, okay, let me just see if I can get a doctor over. And then, you know, credit to the A&E I was in, I had an amazing A&E doctor come over. He was like the best and he was really understanding. So it's just who you get. And he came over and he put his hands on my stomach, which no one had done. He could literally feel the cyst from the outside. It was so big. My stomach was so swollen in the area and so... Yeah, that was what led me to a diagnosis the second time. But it all was because I was being turned away again and asked if I was under stress or if I wasn't, I don't know, whatever it was that they were saying. And I stood up for myself and said, actually, I'm not going to go. Like, I'm not coping.
Yeah. So advocate for yourself if you believe something's wrong. Because I do think our intuition is key.
So
if you think, this doesn't just apply to endometriosis, if you think something is wrong and you are in an unimaginable amount of pain, that you have to, no one else can say it for you.
No one else can say it for you. Although on that note, I think if you are struggling, no one can say it for you, but I think if you're somebody who it doesn't come naturally to you to feel, you know, some people would find that really hard pushing back. Medical professionals have a position of authority and it's not easy for everyone to communicate how they're feeling. So, you know, maybe if you do have like a family member or a friend or somebody that you feel will kind of stand up for you, maybe take them with you.
On the back of that key about, you know, if someone, a medical professional, like doesn't take you seriously or tries to dismiss you, there is something quite topical at the moment called Martha's Rule, which is actually named after a young girl that died. And it's going to be rolled out in UK around April time, where you can advocate for a second opinion if you're not satisfied with the first one you had. So I think that's something for people listening to be aware of, that the NHS is under incredible strain, but you are entitled to get, you know, get help. No one should be suffering. And I think that, you know, for women, we're way more, it's a cultural thing, but like you say, like where one, our pain is not taken as seriously, and is two, we're kind of expected to have a level of pain. And like we've been told that periods can make you sick and make you fall over, and that's just not the truth.
It's not the truth. And there's also, you know, I think actually just kind of coming back to something you asked about advice. I think there's a bit of shame around periods and period related illnesses, although there's a lot of research to suggest that endometriosis is not a condition that's just about periods, but I'm not a researcher. That's a whole other conversation. You know, I think people feel embarrassed to say something, and I've never taken extensive time off work, but when I have, and I've had like male bosses, I've been like a bit shy of being, of saying what it is. I don't know why. Like, why is that? Like, everyone's got wives or daughters or like a woman in their life, like that's probably had some sort of issue relating to gynecological health. But yeah, I think just say it. Like, I've started doing that now. Like, I will say, like, it's endometriosis and it's a condition that affects my ovaries and I need a surgery. And the men that I have said that to have been amazing, and they're not really very awkward about it. And maybe I've been lucky, but I think that was more my sort of embarrassment over it. And I think, again, this is part of the reason why we're conditioned to think that pain and is normal and these sort of symptoms are normal, because we're a little bit embarrassed to talk about it. And I think the more we all talk about it with men and women and everyone, I think that the better things will be. I've been doing some work with the Endometriosis Foundation. It's a patient-led organisation by an amazing woman called Carla. You can read about her story on their website. And when I was looking at, you know, different foundations to potentially help and be an ambassador for, that Carla's organisation really jumped out at me, because I think she implements things that are really helpful to patients. I think she's got an incredible board of medical professionals and researchers and fertility specialists that, you know, host webinars on all kinds of different topics. You know, we host, or Carla hosts, meetups for endometriosis. We did one a few months back, and we had different professionals around the table. So we had some patient stories like mine and one other lady's. We had a nutritionist, for example. She was amazing. Sophie, I think her name was. And she gave, you know, some tips about anti-inflammatory diet and some things that she's seen work with her patients. Carla had a health psychologist there that talked about, you know, the emotional impacts of going through chronic illness. And you know, there was a lot of people in the audience, maybe kind of 50 or so. And I think there was a lot of practical advice there that they could walk away with. And so I would encourage anybody that thinks they have the condition to go on the Endometriosis Foundation website and check it out.
And I know you were recently in the House of Parliament. What is it she's trying to, and you were there with her, what is it that they're campaigning for?
So they are campaigning for particularly about fertility, and they're campaigning for better access to fertility treatments for patients with severe endometriosis. So my understanding is right now that patients with endometriosis who are going to struggle to conceive because of their condition, or even have a surgery, you know, severe surgery, you know, the endo's got so bad that they have to have their ovaries removed or, you know, fallopian tubes, whatever it is, that they will not be able to conceive and have children. Right now, there's no option for those patients to get access to egg preservation on the NHS. And so, you know, that for other conditions, and, you know, it's great that it's available for other conditions, you can. If you're going to be made infertile by your condition, you can access egg freezing. But for endometriosis, that doesn't exist right now. So the campaign in Parliament is about trying to pass a movement or a law eventually, the process that will provide these patients access to fertility treatments.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That was really helpful. And I think that I'm really glad we had that chat, because, like I say, when I've posted, you guys that follow me on Instagram, the reaction's been insane. And it feels like people there's a mixture of frustration, fear, and like you say, no answers. So the
Endometriosis Foundation.
Head there and then you can get some information.
Head there, check out Carla's story and everything she's doing, and you will find some really good advice there.
Amazing.
So my lovely producer, I've just put together a sister edition of who's most likely to. So I'm going to say a thing, who's the what or who, and we both have to basically point. We have to do it on instinct.
Okay.
Who's the most emotional? You. Me.
You.
Then me. You. Me. But then in my group of friends, in my workplace, I'm not emotional.
I don't think you're emotional like a crier, but you take the bait. Like, throw out a little hook and you'll bite. And I won't. I'll
By
just
people,
hang up.
Do you mean our mother?
Yeah.
Maybe. Most likely to do something weird in public?
Yeah.
Me. Who would catch feelings the quickest?
You.
Yeah, I thought it. Well, obviously we're both married now, but just paint for a little picture. My sister's been with her husband since she was. This is fucking insane. I don't know how we went even
17.
17.
I know.
Consistently, no breakup. Mm. They're married. So her husband he's more than a brother-in-law. I can't actually remember life without him. He lived at our house at one point for like 2 years.
Yeah.
And then I've probably had I was going to throw a number. A lot of boyfriends in that time.
I want to say 5.
Yeah. And I love to like meet someone and bring them home like the next day or like on a family holiday. And there's been some freaks. Like, and they all...
I do find it weird that some of these people that you dated like exist in our family memories because you took them places. And I'm like, why are they here?
Like at weddings or family photos.
Yeah, it's just kind of strange because I think back and I'm like, I have these memories of like certain things. And I'm like, oh... Who was that? Like, he was there.
Oh, yeah. Caught feelings. I catch feelings quick. Yeah. I fall in love overnight.
Mm.
Worked out really well for me. Most likely to break someone's heart. You.
Oh.
Probably. Probably. I don't know, though, but you've been the same.
Be hard to, like, whose heart am I breaking?
Well, maybe me, then. I guess oh, it's hard to break. So I was just trying to think if any of the people I've dated even have hearts.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That definitely applies to at least two.
Who's the funniest?
That's a tough one. I'm surprised you're having to think about that. I'm surprised you're not like, oh, me.
No, I obviously wear being funny as like a badge of honour. It's a big part of my self-worth. However, you are funny and you are quick-witted and like you're mean with it and there's not many people that make me laugh as much as you do.
Yeah, like, and you like, actually.
Your turn of phrase, it's more when we're like taking the piss out of people we know. Oh, we can just, I can howl laughing. Like, because we have the same sense of humour. And obviously, I think as well, we have the same approach to things where we do use humour. Like, things get so
fucking mechanism.
Yeah, things get so weird. And then, like, in the darkest situation, like, I don't know, I can imagine, this is so dark, but maybe wrong. I can imagine I could be, like, dying and she'd be, like, coming and be like, you're dying, bitch.
Oh, my God. Or if I died and I was in the coffin, like, wearing one of your items.
I'd undress
clothing,
you.
You'd be like, that's I'd my undress fucking blazer.
Her. I'd undress your limp body.
You'd be like, open the coffin and take it off her.
I would. If I had any good jewellery on in my coffin, she'd take it.
I actually would, because otherwise it's just a waste, so...
Who would be more... Oh, this is a bit deep since we're both newly-ish married. Who's most likely to get cheated on?
Oh, it's going to be you, though.
Yeah, but it is, because her husband's just way more...
Scared.
Brad's way more feral. Who eats the most?
Me, for sure.
To know, though, but your eating habits are a bit weird, though. You go long periods of time without eating.
It's like a distracting.
It's like an unintentional fast. Like, we was in Hamburg visiting my nan, and it got to, like, 4 o'clock, and she was like, I feel really sick. And I was like, what have you eaten today? And she was like, a coffee.
Yeah. Sometimes I do that, but then I feel like if we go out for dinner, I'll want everything on the menu, and I'll actually want
to eat
the whole thing.
Who spends more money?
Oh, you. You. For sure.
You have two horses.
Two horses. The horse thing brings it.
Really relatable, by the way.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
But then don't you think, though, that costs more than what's...
It could do. If we added up...
I reckon what I do... Typically, well, right, when we was younger, I mean, pocket money, allowance, anything, money I had for my first job, just where I was a spender. Yeah, I'm a saver. Yeah. Like, I'm a bit like, oh, I could be dead next week. Fuck yeah.
So like, I feel like with that in mind... You spend more.
Oh, my God. I'm not even... Who takes longer getting ready?
Weirdly, me.
Yeah.
Weirdly, me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm slow.
You are... It's insane. For someone that works in such a high-pressure environment, when she's out of the office, she really takes the fucking
kick the fuck back every time.
So on her hen do, because I am just... I'm just... She's going to live longer. I read something that people that don't care about being late for social things will live longer. And I hate to be late. And I'm very, like, methodical in everything I do. So I said to her friends on the hen do, I said, right, I've made all the reservations. We tell her everything is an hour earlier.
They did actually.
No one breaks. I said, because then we have a half a chance of being there for the actual time. And you only clocked on, like, day four. And you were like, we keep being so early for these dinners.
Oh, my God, I actually said that.
And I was, like, looking across the table to your friends.
I'm so slow. Every time I think it takes me an hour to get ready, I'm like, it's an hour, but it's not. It's like three.
The amount of holidays we've done, obviously, over the years, and her husband's like comes down to the bar, and he just looks like broken, and we're like, "Where's Georgia?" And he's like, in a towel on the bed, and we're like ordering starters.
I know. I get so distracted as well. Like sometimes I just want to kick back in my dressing gown.
And you don't do this as much anymore, but when we were going for our real sister, like the competitiveness bit was like on another level. Like you'd come downstairs, like I don't know if I was wearing a dress, but earlier in the day I'd been like, oh, casual. She'd come down and we both would do this and she'd go, right. And she'd just leave. And go and change because she would have thought that I'd said I'm going casual, so then she would be like, and then you come down and be like,
I'd like one up you.
You'd be like,
if you had 5-inch heels on, yeah, come down, I'll do like 6-inch heels.
Who's most likely to forget someone's birthday?
Me,
yeah. But again, this comes back to my like weird thing. Who's the messiest?
Me,
you, George. Thanks for coming on. I can't actually believe that I've got you to come on and we had a really good chat,
yeah,
and didn't fall out. And now, you know, my listeners get to know a bit more about you and hopefully take away some pretty valuable nuggets.
I hope so.
From the sensible sister.
That's what our parents think.
Yeah.
This week's episode of So Wrong It's Right was brought to you by Foxy Bingo. Put some fox in your day with new, quick and interactive bingo experiences all at the tip of your finger. They have a huge range of free, classic and exclusive games you can play with your mates to keep the party going. Want to connect with other players? Foxy Bingo has a community chat so you can always feel part of the Foxy pack. So get your fox on by heading to Foxy Bingo today. 18+, begambleaware.org, T's and C's apply.